stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
Why do Catholics worship Mary?
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest? Where is purgatory in the Bible?
What's stopping you?
I think the Pope has too much authority.
What's stopping you?
You
are called to communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Well, welcome to another edition of EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. It's our show primarily geared towards our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. But if you're in conversation with a non-Catholic or a fallen away Catholic, we would love to take your calls as well. If you'd like to be part of the program, the number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, we'd still love to hear from you. That number is 1-205-271-2985. And we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. And you can always send us an email. That email address is ctc@ewtn.com. I'm Jack Williams, Pedro Quiles producing the program. Your call screener is Matt Gubensky and Michael McCall handling our social media efforts. So if you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, you can type a question into the chat window and it may find its way to us by the end of the program. And our host, as he is every day on this program, Dr. David Anders, how are you?
I'm doing decent. Jack, how about you?
Pretty darn good, all things considered.
Glad to hear it.
Got an email here from Martha. She says, you've mentioned before that Martin Luther wasn't opposed to the real presence, but the sacrifice. Can adoration of the Blessed Sacrament without fail in the sacrifice... Well, excuse me. Can adoration to the Blessed Sacrament without faith in the sacrifice of the Mass become superstitious and be one of the causes of the apparent crisis in the Western Catholic Church and in the priesthood? Can you elaborate?
Yeah, that's an amazingly insightful question. And I think for this to make sense to the audience, we've really got to break it down because it's quite possible a lot of people don't know what we're talking about, right? So when Christ instituted the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, he instituted a rite, R-I-T-E, right, a ritual that the Church was to perform in perpetuity until he comes again. And he says specifically, in memory of me, right? And so in the language of the Eucharistic prayer, if you listen to what the priest says, he talks about the Mass as the memorial of the death and resurrection of Jesus. And what does it mean for it to be the memorial? Now, a lot of times Catholics get a little bit nervous when they hear theologians talk about memorials because they think, well, is he saying that the Eucharist is just symbolic, that there's no supernatural reality there? No, not saying that at all. So don't worry, okay? We fully affirm the doctrine of Christ's real presence in the Eucharist. But that being the case, even though Christ is truly there present, it also memorializes something, namely what took place on Calvary. Now, how does it do that? How does it do that? Well, there's a reason that Jesus gave us a sacrifice based upon the consecration of bread and wine rather than just bread or just wine. And it's because the bread and the wine before the consecration stand for, as it were, body over here, blood over there. And then, of course, they become body and blood, soul and divinity, but they also figure it in the way they appear. Like, you can't see the real presence, but you can see the two species that are consecrated, and they're set up on the altar in such a way that they're presented in a state of separation. They're not one thing, they're two different things. And the significance of that is it calls to our mind, yes, it does call to a mind, it does. This is a symbol in this sense, the fact that Jesus' blood and his body were separated at Calvary. And so it's through the double consecration of the two elements, body here, blood there, that what happened on Calvary is recalled to us. Now, it is in this act of memorial that the Church regards the Eucharistic rite itself as of sacrificial value. Namely, I mean, it's very specific when it talks about this. The Council of Trent says that the Eucharist is a true sacrifice, and therefore it has propitiatory value in appeasing the wrath of God and reconciling us to Him. But it does so in an unbloody manner, meaning the victim who is being offered is not killed on the altar. He died at Calvary 2,000 years ago. He doesn't die again. This is an unbloody offering. That was a bloody offering. This memorializes the bloody offering, but it's unbloody. So there's no actual death of the victim. However, here's where transubstantiation comes in. Here's where the real presence comes in. Even though it just memorializes the death and doesn't repeat it, the same victim who died at Calvary is actually present in the memorial offering. So this is what makes this offering different from any other kind of memorial, namely, the victim who's being memorialized is actually on hand. He's there, and in several modes. One, he's there through transubstantiation, the real presence in the consecrated elements, but he's also there in the intention of the priest who effects the sacrifice through the consecration. That's why the priest's role is so critical. He's not just a real presence manufacturing machine. He's actually performing a sacrificial rite. And to neglect that element actually vitiates the whole sacrifice. See, there was a case in the 16th century where after Henry VIII left the Catholic Church, started the Anglican Church, after Henry died, his son Edward came to the throne, and they changed the rite of ordination to deny the sacrificial aspect of the priest's character. And it was that act, wasn't separation from Rome, it was the act of denying the sacrificial character of the priesthood, that the priest was a sacrificer, that vitiated Anglican orders and made them null and void from that point on. So your question is, could you have a superstitious belief in the Eucharist if all you had was the doctrine of the real presence and you denied the doctrine of sacrifice? Well, in this respect, yes, because the way we appropriate the sacrifice for ourselves is we join ourselves to it. We make it our intent to imitate what's presented. St. Augustine said, Christians become what you see, right? You witness the memorial of the sacrifice. You purpose, you determine to make your life a sacrifice to God like Christ's. And then by taking Holy Communion, you complete this intrinsic act of oblation of Christ in you offering yourselves together to God the Father. If you were to worship the Eucharist, but to renounce the idea of personal sacrifice, you know, St. Paul says offering your bodies as living service is your spiritual act of worship. If you denied that act of sacrifice, that act of charity, that act of self-giving that's intrinsic to the meaning of the sacrifice, then you would be receiving it in a superstitious manner.
Just getting started, EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. If you'd like to be part of the program, pick up the phone and give us a call, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. If you'd like to be part of the program, we've still got a couple of open phone lines for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Got a great new item here from EWTN's religious catalog. It's a Passion Crucifix. Mother Angelica always spoke of the importance of having holy reminders in our homes. And the love and mercy of our Lord and His great sacrifice will be reminded to us. And EWTN's religious catalog has an intricately detailed crucifix that features Jesus after His death. The resin corpus shows the blood streaming down His body and even the stripes on His back where the soldiers had flogged Him during the scourging. The cross is made of a smooth, beveled, dark wood. It's 11 inches wide by 22.5 inches high. It's a sawtooth hanger on the back of this for easy display. It's available now at EWTN's religious catalog. That's EWTNRC.com. They're offering free standard shipping on online orders of $75 or more. That is standard shipping in the continental U.S. only. Use the word free at checkout. Again, 833-288-3986 is our toll-free number. First up today is Eric in Wichita, Kansas, watching us on YouTube today. Eric, thanks for holding. You're on with Dr. David Anders.
Hi, Dr. David Anders. And is it Jack?
It is. Sitting in today for Tom Price.
Okay. Hi, Jack. Good to talk to you guys. So here's my question. I just recently got into teaching catechetical classes, and I'm actually doing apologetics online, and I noticed a lot of polemical abrasive attitudes and words, and you know, people getting puffed up, and it seems like a lot of people are just wanting to win arguments, and they're not necessarily concerned about the salvation of souls. So my question is, what advice, what techniques, what methods, I mean, aside from prayer, obviously, could you give me? Because I think you, whether you believe it or not, are really humble for how smart you are, and you're kind of like a role model for me, and I want to kind of emulate that. So what kind of advice could you give me?
I really appreciate the question. To me, this is a wonderful question. It really warms my heart to hear it. I don't hear this kind of question often, but it really goes to the heart and soul of my philosophy of being in Catholic ministry. So I've thought about this question a lot, and for some of the same reasons that you have. I grew up in an environment that was really keen on proselytizing, and it could really come down to really wanting to just kind of win a feather for your cap rather than caring about the integral good of another soul. And I can actually remember a time when I was a non-Catholic when I proselytized a Catholic and got them to switch allegiance, so to speak. And shamefully, I no longer remember the person's name or anything about their personal life for the distinct reason that I didn't ask, right? Because in the moment, all I cared about was winning. I just cared about winning, you know, kind of like a carnival barker, you know, attracting a mark. It was, you know, or a salesman or something. And looking back on it, I just feel dirty when I remember that interchange, not just because I led somebody out of the Catholic faith, but because of my motives, which really ultimately self-seeking, and we're not seeking the good of the other. And of course, I don't think Jesus reflected this behavior in the slightest. I mean, conspicuously, when people turned around and wanted to leave Jesus, he was like, see ya, off you go. You know, he was not counting numbers, and his pride was not at stake in the outcome, right? It was care for the other human being. When he met the rich young ruler, and the guy says to him, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Jesus says, why are you calling me good? You already know what to do. It's a very kind of self-deprecating answer. And then the text tells us when the young man said, oh, all these things I've done since I was a youth, Christ, that St. Mark tells us, the other Gospels don't say this, is why I like Mark's version the best. Mark tells us Jesus looked at him and loved him. And what did he invite him to do? Come live with him. How many of us would be willing to do that? Somebody comes and challenges our Catholic faith, and we're like, come live with me. You know, not many. Okay. So how do we do this? Well, first of all, I think it's really helpful to think through what the Catholic faith says, what the Catholic Church teaches about what faith is. And if you go back and look at the Vatican I dogmatic declaration on the faith, it actually teaches as a dogma that you cannot, is an impossibility. It's metaphysically impossible to generate faith in another human being through deductive logic. You cannot do it. You cannot do it. To claim that you can do it is actually a heresy. Now, a lot of what motivates the kind of polemical apologetics online that you're talking about implicitly is the belief that I can coerce you into the act of faith. Now, here's what I can do. I can coerce you into an act of bad faith. I can manipulate you so that I conceal, that I hyperbolize, that I present the evidence in a certain light so that you feel compelled by logic to draw a certain conclusion. But the Catholic Church tells us that kind of intellectual activity is not what we mean by faith. Faith is much more like the commitment you make to your spouse, which, while there can be reasons to commit to a particular man or woman in holy matrimony, and there ought to be good reasons to do so, those reasons ultimately don't compel the will. They make it reasonable to make this choice. But the choice is an existential one that's made freely because you want to enter into communion with that soul. And the ultimate motive for becoming Catholic, I'm persuaded personally, is that I want to live a Catholic way of life. Right? And that's more than just drawing a deductive conclusion. Secondly, you know, Cardinal Newman wrote a lot about this topic in his essay, In Aid of a Grammar of Assent. And he said, you know, when people actually do assent to propositions, it's generally because those propositions conform to their basic intuitions about the world that they formed in pre-rational, non-rational ways, their upbringing, their parents, their culture, their genetics, their temperament, you name it. And so if you really want someone to sort of look at the world through Catholic eyes, you have to do more than just persuade them through logical deduction, although that can be helpful. You really need to invite them into a sort of fully orbed appreciation of the inside of Catholic life in all of its richness and beauty and harmony. And so things like introducing people to friendship with the saints and your own sanctified and virtuous activity is just as important, if not much more important, than having a particular kind of deductive logic. It's one of the reasons I think Bishop Barron's, then he was Robert Barron, he wasn't bishop yet, when he made that great Catholicism series for public television. It was all about drawing people into the beauty of Catholic culture and, you know, really trying to come to see the world through Catholic eyes and to appreciate what the Church had to offer long before I considered the question of, is it actually true or not, right? There is a temptation for the apologist to fall into what the Church calls Gnosticism, which is the doctrine that I can be saved by holding the proper set of propositions. And that's dangerous for so many reasons, right? And not least of which is that it neglects the principal value of charity and the virtues. And it also tends to construe reality in a kind of us-them black-white way where, you know, where I assess the value of a human being by the ideas they hold rather than the character that they live by. So Gnosticism is just deeply dangerous. For all these reasons, the doctrine of faith itself, the you already mentioned the threat of pride, right? The you know, you remember that old Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, Conan the Barbarian, where someone asks him, you know, what is best in life? And he says, you know, to crush your enemies and see them fleeing before you, you know, and that attitude can come into religious discussion when all I really care about is grinding that other guy's face into the dirt. And if I succeed in doing that, the last thing in the world I'm going to evoke is a loving embrace of the character that I'm displaying, right? So I think holding all those things in mind. So what should you do when you engage in apologetics, in my judgment? Well, remember what St. Peter says about apologetics, that it is the art of being ready to give an answer. Being ready to give an answer if someone asks you for the reasons of the hope that is in you. And rather than the goal of apologetics being rhetorical combat in some sort of spirited debate, it's simply the goal of being able to give an answer for the reasons for the hope that I have within me. And if you remember that, my objective here is not to proselytize the soul and manipulate them, but to invite them to view reality through a Catholic lens and let them see that it can be done reasonably, that it can be done rationally. And if I've accomplished that, then I've accomplished my goal, recognizing that ultimately it's up to the work of the Holy Spirit to bring about the supernatural virtue of faith. And so attention to the danger that it poses to me, right? If I slip from that attitude, and I had this happen to me recently, actually. I was out and I had a professional meeting that had nothing to do with Catholic radio, and the fellow I was talking to was not Catholic, and he kind of started poking me on Catholic stuff. And, you know, I let my pride get the best of me, and I went into polemical mode, you know, kind of went back on the attack for a bit. And when I walked out of there, I was like, I don't ever want to do that again. You know, I thought I'd put that way behind me. So the temptation is always there. And that's a danger to my soul, right? Because it's not motivated ultimately by love of that person, desire for their integral good. And you know, ultimately, when someone, Tom Price likes to talk about people who are in receive mode, whether or not they're in receive mode. If they're just in attack and destroy mode, then I'm going to deflect from apologetics and maybe ask them out for pizza and beer. You know, just try to change the dynamic.
Thanks, Eric. Great question. We appreciate it today. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number, 833-288-3986. Next stop for us is Pompano Beach, Florida. Donna is listening on the EWTN app today. Donna, welcome to the program. You're on with Dr. Anders.
Good afternoon, Dr. Anders. I'd like to know, what are the sacraments of initiation?
Yeah, thank you so much. The sacraments of initiation are baptism, confirmation, and our first Holy Communion. When we have that whole package, there is nothing left in terms of forming you into your Catholic identity. Now, you need to grow in virtue and charity after that, and the mystical life and prayer and all these sorts of things. But in terms of, you know, am I a Catholic? Have I made it in? Have I punched the card? The sacraments of initiation are what signal that you are fully initiated into the Catholic Church. And so, obviously, there's three of them. So that means you could be at various stages of initiation. So, for example, we get calls from people from time to time on this show that say, well, you know, I was baptized as a Catholic as a child, but when I was 4, 5, 6 years old, my parents left the Catholic Church and they raised us in this other Christian denomination. What is my status in the Catholic Church? And we would say, well, you're Catholic. You're Catholic. I mean, you were baptized in the Catholic Church. You're part of the body of Christ, but you're not fully initiated. You know, and you haven't had that strengthening of your character for public witness to the Catholic faith that is the sacrament of confirmation. And crucially, if you're not actively receiving communion in the Catholic faith as part of the holy sacrifice of the Mass, then you're not actively engaged in the Church's act of worship. I mean, this is the principal thing that the Church does, is offer worship to Almighty God as a corporate body. And our communion is how we buy into that, so to speak. So baptism fits you for the sacrifice, makes you clean, purifies you, so you can lawfully and reasonably take place in that sacrifice. But to actually be taken place, you got to be present at Holy Mass, and of course, you know, every holy day of obligation and every feast of Sunday as well. So you got to have all three.
Thanks, Donna. We appreciate that call today. 833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. I have a new want-to location on my radar now.
Okay.
Brandon is calling us from Spearfish, South Dakota.
They do a lot of spearfishing there?
Brandon might be able to tell us. He's listening on Real Presence Radio. Brandon, you're on with Dr. Anders.
What can I tell you? I'm sorry, I missed it.
Whether there's any spearfishing going on in Spearfish.
The Native Americans, I believe, used to back in the day, but no.
Okay. Well, there you go. What can we do for you?
My question is, Dr. Anders, you said the sacrifice of the Mass propitiates God's wrath.
Yes.
Why is God angry? And then I'm wondering, the scripture that said, by his stripes you are healed. I'm wondering what that means. And then isn't double imputation in the spirituality of Catholicism?
Oh, these are all great questions. If I miss one, remind me. Okay, so let's start with wrath. So it is a scriptural way, it's a biblical way to talk about the wrath of God as the alienation that we experience from him when we sin. Now, we have to be careful. We're going to speak as theologians and not just as in sort of biblical devotional terms. We have to recognize that as Catholics, we don't actually think that God has emotions because he doesn't change. And emotions are a biological phenomenon. They're a neurological phenomenon. And they are, by definition, passions that come and go. And God doesn't have passions because he doesn't change at all. He's just the permanent, eternal, unchanging disposition to do good. Because love is his very nature, and so he doesn't actually feel the emotion of anger. And yet we talk in those terms. It's a kind of condescension to human language, a kind of anthropomorphism in our language, to recognize that from our point of view, from where we're standing, we really can be alienated from God. And I like this analogy. So you imagine the light of the sun. Now, you know, imagine the sun is just constantly beaming its rays down onto planet Earth. And then you walk out in the backyard, but you put up an umbrella, and there's the umbrella blocking out the light of the sun. And you're like, oh my, I'm standing in the dark. Well, you know, all you have to do is put the umbrella down, and then there's the sun. God's love is kind of like that. It's always constant and unchanging, but our sin interposes and can block the flow of that divine benevolence out of our lives. And when we experience that, we can call that wrath in a kind of condescension to language. Now, what we do about that in the Mass, I can get to on the other side of the break.
Straight ahead, we'll talk to not only Philip in Washington, but Suzanne, Gino, and we've got plenty of time for your calls as well. The number is 833-288-EWTN. Congratulations going out to another EWTN radio partner. Athens Catholic Radio, serving Athens, Georgia, is celebrating 8 years with EWTN. Congratulations to George Sagalis and everyone at WXPB from your friends here at EWTN Radio. One open line for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. We're talking to Brandon in Spearfish, South Dakota, and he wants to know, among other things, why is God mad?
Yep, exactly. So before the break, we really kind of broke down theological language and what Catholics mean when they talk about God's emotions, wrath being one of them. And really, God doesn't have emotions the way we do. And so when we talk about wrath, we're really talking about the alienation that we experience from God that is the result of our own sin. It's not that, you know, God's up there fuming and, you know, biting his fingernails off. He doesn't have fingernails. But we really do experience alienation from the goodness of God. I mean, here's a very weak analogy. I mean, I could experience alienation from the truths of mathematics, say, by not studying mathematics, right? Mathematics doesn't change. The extent to which I can rationally participate in their truth is going to be kind of up to me. And it's sort of similar. If God is nothing but unchanging infinite love, then I'm alienated from that love to the extent that I myself am not loving. So the question, how does the Mass fix that? How does the Mass propitiate God, or how does it reconcile us to God? Well, when Jesus wants you to do something, it's very interesting. He represents it in a sacrament. So he wants you to be born again. That is to change your life, turn from evil to good. So he gives a sacrament that's totally ordered towards the change of life from evil to good, that dying with sin, rising with righteousness. Well, he wants us to make our lives of self-sacrifice, self-offering. That is what love means. And so he gives us a sacrifice that represents his own self-offering. It makes it present to us in a mystical way through the real presence, so that we ourselves can join with Christ and give our lives in sacrifice to God and love of our brethren. And if we do that, if we become people of love, well, then voila, we're reconciled to God, all right? Now, the second question was, what does it mean in the Scriptures when it says, when it speaks of us being healed by Jesus' stripes? Well, the book of Isaiah is where this prophecy comes from, describes the suffering servant who, from one point of view within the context of Isaiah, seems to refer to either Israel as a whole or to the exiled portion of Israel. And the prophet is writing about the way the exilic community would have been viewed by their contemporaries, and so, you know, in the typical logic of the ancient Near Eastern world, if you were getting the stuffing beat out of you, then it just seemed obvious that God was on the side of the victor and against the loser. And the biblical narrative is unique in world literature for turning that dynamic upside down and saying, actually, God was on the side of the loser. And you don't find that in any other ancient culture. It's always God on the side of the winner. But the biblical narrative says, no, God's actually on the side of the loser. You may have...
God actually is the loser.
He actually is the loser. We don't learn that until the incarnation, though. We learn that in the incarnation. So you might... The text says, you know, we regarded him as afflicted by God, cut off. You know, in other words, people would have seen his suffering and thought it was evidence of divine wrath. In fact, it was not. It was the means that God was going to use to redeem the world. And then, of course, from the New Testament perspective, we now recognize that this is not just about the exilic community in Babylon, but it actually is a prophecy of what Christ would sum up, would recapitulate in his own person, that he takes on that entire identity of Israel, alienated and exiled, entering into solidarity with the human race, suffering everything that a human could suffer, only without sin, and triumphs over it victoriously out of honor and obedience to God in total humility and a gift of self-offering. And that kind of radical commitment on Jesus's part is so meritorious, so infinitely meritorious, that God accepts the sacrifice of Christ as adequate atonement for sin. And again, the dynamic of our entering into it is particularly in our appropriation of that sacrifice through the holy sacrifice of the Mass. Now, the last question Brandon had was, is double imputation part of Catholic theology or spirituality? Big words, let me define them. In typical Reformed theology, that's the Calvinist tradition that came out of the Protestant Reformation, the way the Reformers thought about the death of Christ was they imagined that God is... you know, not just metaphorically angry the way I described at the beginning of the show, but actually angry. Like, God does sort of have emotions and human characteristics, and he's genuinely mad, and he really has an intrinsic need that's essential to his nature to expiate his wrath upon a subject. He can't let go of it, and justice can't be satisfied unless God has expiated his wrath. He's punished somebody for something. And but he has a will to save humanity. This, again, is the Protestant view, not the Catholic view. And so what he does is he cuts a deal, as it were, with Jesus, the innocent Son of God, and he punishes Jesus for sins that Jesus did not commit, and then accounts Christ's righteousness, Christ's obedience, to the part of faithful humans as if they, in fact, had been obedient, even though they were disobedient. So he punishes the innocent and acquits the guilty. You know, sort of changes the accounts. That you know, the name on the bank account gets switched, and the way to access that in your own life is through the act of faith. So it kind of undergirds Luther's doctrine of justification by faith alone. If you just have faith, then God will credit Christ's righteousness to your account, and he'll punish Jesus in place of you. So the question is that part of Catholic understanding? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. The Catholic doctrine of atonement I just described. You know, Christ's loving self-authoring is regarded by God as meritorious. It pleases God. He's not the recipient of divine anger. Even less is God punishing an innocent person to acquit guilty people. We have a word for that behavior in most languages. We call it unjust. A judge who punishes innocent people and acquits guilty people, we call that an unjust judge. We think God, however, is a just judge. He punishes the guilty and acquits the innocent. What we need is to be made innocent. Not in fiction, not in law, not by some fiction of imputation, but in reality. We need our sin washed away. We need our character reformed so that God can look at us and say, well done, good and faithful servant. We can't do that on our own. Not by my own strength can I do that. But with the grace of God, I can in fact be transformed so that the love of God is poured into my heart. That's what the Catholic Church thinks takes place in our relationship with Jesus.
Next up is Philip in the great state of Washington, listening to us on Two Hearts Catholic Radio. Philip, you're on with Dr. David Andrews.
Thank you, Jack. And first-time caller, Dr. Andrews, and I just want to tell you as a context here, after 2 years living with a spouse who's been very faithful to the church, who's a convert, I have decided, you talked about the receiving mode earlier and the initiation, I have decided I want to join the church, and a lot of it has had to do with the EWTN. I just want to
fantastic
let you know that in this show. So,
hey, you give your wife a big attagirl for us.
You want to get moving? What's that, Jack?
Give your wife a big attagirl for us.
I will. Her name's Sharon. So, hey, so as somebody new and wants to read, a couple things here. What were the reasons, and you've answered this a dozen times, I know, what were the reasons why the Reformation came about? Was the Catholic Church was not perfect, and I can see a Protestant coming back at you and saying, hey, look at the church, this horrible thing, and I'm really quite ignorant, and maybe you could give me a thumbnail sketch.
Oh, yeah.
I'll ask you just one more question.
This is probably, like, if you're going to ask me my three favorite questions to get on Call to Communion, this is definitely one of them, okay? So there is a very common misperception of the origins of the Reformation, and it's you'll find it among Catholics just as much as among Protestants. I mean, when I give talks on this and I sort of take a poll about why do you think there was a Reformation, most people will say, well, the Reformation happened because the church was corrupt. And church was corrupt. That is absolutely not the reason there was a Reformation. In my judgment, as a historian of the Reformation, well, does it play a role? Of course it plays a role, but it's totally insufficient, utterly insufficient as an explanation. And here's why. Yes, the church was corrupt in the 16th century. Let me give you a little piece of inside knowledge. It was corrupt in the 1st century, and the 2nd century, and the 3rd century, and the 4th. The other day I was reading John Cassian, the 5th century monastic writer. He said, he was writing young monks, and he said, if you want to be holy, avoid women and bishops. Right, because the ones he had met, you know, didn't amount to much. And here we are in the 21st century. Lo and behold, the church is still corrupt. So if corruption itself were a sufficient explanation of the Protestant Reformation, then we should have had Martin Luther in every century of the church's history, right? And we should have had something like Lutheran Protestantism should have popped up, say, in 4th century Coptic Egypt. Well, guess what? It did not. right? Or in Byzantium in the 7th century. Well, guess what? Nothing like Lutheranism popped up, right? Lutheranism popped up in Northern Europe, in Germanic, Northern, Latinate Europe, in the early stages of the 16th century, you know, embedded in a very particular culture for highly contextualized reasons that are complex and economic, demographic, technological, intellectual, cultural, spiritual, you name it. There was a famous historian of the Reformation, a Frenchman, wrote 100 years ago named Lucien Febvre, and he wrote a very famous essay called A Badly Posed Question, The Origins of the Reformation, meaning that to approach the history of the Reformation with the what is the cause as your frame of reference is you're going to really miss the whole dynamic. And what Lefebvre stressed, and I think he was right about this, and I think most people agree, is that what you see is a cultural evolution that takes place over centuries where mentalities shift, right? What the way people construe reality and church and relationship to God as an entire culture, there's a centuries-long process of evolution, and all that has to be taken into account to give a robust description of the Reformation. Let me give you just one little example of that. In 1535, I think it was, there was a celebrated event in Reformation history where an anonymous author wrote basically a tract attacking the Catholic Church and the Catholic Mass. It was called The Placards, and posted them all around the city of Paris. You know, imagine waking up one morning and all these posters up on the wall attacking the sacrifice of the Mass and attacking the Church. And notoriously, somebody managed to get one on the inside of the bedroom of the King of France. So there's somebody in the royal household that was sympathetic and put it inside the king's bedroom. Imagine if Truman had woken up one morning and found a copy of the Communist Manifesto on his bedside table in the White House. That's like the equivalent. Okay, what's going on here? Somebody's really way too close to the top guy, right? Made Francis really mad. He hung a bunch of Protestants off the balcony at Amboise and killed them just for good measure. But what the content of the thing was what was interesting. It was an attack on the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, but if you read through all the complaints, one stuck out at me when I read these for the first time. This fellow says, you know, and the priests these days, they're worthless, you know, they don't even read. And I thought, what a fascinating complaint. No one would have made it in 9th century Saxony. Like, there was anti-clericalism in 9th century Saxony, you know, but if you'd asked what's wrong with the clergy, literacy rates would not have been near the top of the complaint list. Why? Nobody read. It wasn't part of the culture. And so there were things about the Reformation that presupposed stuff like the development of literacy and the invention of printing. So famously, there's a book on this topic by Natalie Davis about the city of Lyon in the 1520s, 30s, and 40s, and 50s. And she said, in the early stages of the Reformation, the printer's journeymen, think of these guys as the computer programmers of Silicon Valley. They were like the cutting edge of technology in the worker class, you know. They all became Protestant in the 1520s. 1550s roll around, they all become Catholic again. Why? What changed? Well, it had to do with their perception of their own social location. You know, as the new guy on the block at the head of bleeding edge technology, they felt self-important. And the Reformation, with this doctrine of the priesthood of all believers, and you don't need a priest, and you interpret the Bible for yourselves, that appealed to that sort of sense of professional pride in them. And they were like, oh, we like that. Get rid of the Pope and be our own boss. But when the Reformation got more institutionalized and more top-down and hierarchical, they went, these guys are worse than the Pope. And they went back, right? Well, that's a conversation that you couldn't have had in previous centuries. At the root of the whole thing was an ideology of reformism and primitivism. The idea that we should reform the church, fix what's wrong in the church by going back to an ancient model of Christianity. But that idea itself is not biblical. And it's not even very traditional. So it has to come from someplace. And we find out actually where it comes from is Catholic monasteries. In the high Middle Ages, particularly in the monastery of Cluny, emerges this idea that you should reform broken Christian institutions by looking back to an ancient model. In the case of the monks, it would have been the Benedictine rule. And when those Benedictine monks enter into the papacy, particularly in the person of Gregory VII, Pope Hildebrand, they say, we're going to bring that ideology of reformism into the Church Universal. And Hildebrand does that, and he seeks to undergo a reform of the church. We're talking 11th century here. But unwittingly, he infuses all of Christendom with the ideology of reformism and invites criticism of the church and its hierarchy. So there's a cultural move there. There's an intellectual move that is a necessary precondition for the Reformation, and it's born actually out of Catholic reformist activity, which will ultimately give birth to, say, the Franciscan Order and the Dominican Order, and then eventually the Augustinian Hermits, of which Luther was a part. And so Luther brought some unique accents, to be sure, some unique intellectual inventions to the Reformation, but he would have been unintelligible apart from social and economic and demographic and cultural changes that were centuries in the making. If you want a good book that goes into this kind of thing, I highly recommend Stephen Osmond's book, The Age of Reform, 1250 to 1550. And if you pay attention to those dates, see, most people date the Reformation beginning in 1517. Osmond has the good sense to start his account of the Reformation in the middle of the 13th century.
And Philip, we've got callers stacked up, so we'll have to ask you to call back with that second question on another day. You know, the wildly popular Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year podcast from Father Mike Schmitz, you can check them out right here on EWTN Radio tonight and every night, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on EWTN Radio. Next up is Gino in Canton, Ohio, watching us on television today. Gino, you are on with Dr. David Anders.
Hello, Doctor.
Howdy.
I want to thank you for sharing your blessings and graces and keeping pure doctrine alive and pure teaching and dogma in our church, for our great truths that we have faith in. I'm making a study of pure doctrine in the church, and I'm up against the incarnation. I don't understand how a finite being, the Virgin Mary creature, can give birth to an infinite, absolute creature like the God, Son of God. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So I've got several things to say. First of all, let's be very clear what we mean when we say that an infinite creature becomes finite. And that's actually not the way the church describes the incarnation. So that's our first problem right there, is we've gotten away from the dogmatic language of the church when we speak that way. What the church talks about is not the infinite becoming finite. It talks about the infinite assuming the finite. And remember, the doctrine of the church is not that Christ, that the second person of the Trinity, simply becomes a human being, but rather that the second person assumes a human nature. And so the person of Jesus has two natures. That is the dogma. The dogma is that there are two natures of Christ, and the divine nature doesn't cease being infinite. That's the thing. So there's not this contraction of the infinite to the finite, right, that the question presupposes. There is rather the addition of a nature, so that you now have one person, two natures, one of which is infinite, the other of which is finite. Now, you could turn around and ask me, Anders, how can you have a person with two natures? I don't know, any more than I know how bread and wine can become the body and blood of Christ, right? This is a mystery of the Catholic faith. But the church is very, very careful in the way that it describes the mystery in order to avoid the kind of conundrums that you have proposed. So, you know, there have been attempts in history to explain the mystery, and all of them have been rendered heretical. Have been declared heretical. So, you know, to take for example, there was a heresy called Apollinarianism, and the Apollinarians believed this. They believed that Jesus had a human body, but instead of a human soul, the divine logos, that is the divine person, simply took up residence in a human body. Well, if you believe in a dualistic anthropology, spirit and, you know, body are two radically separate things, that makes sense. That works. That would seem to resolve the mystery. Church says, that's wrong. You lose. Why? Because then he wouldn't have been a fully human being. He just would have been a human body, a kind of zombie, as it were, right? And Gregory of Nazianzus put it this way. He said, whatever Christ didn't assume is not healed. If he didn't take my human soul, he didn't heal my human soul. And it's not my gout I want fixed. It's my sin, all right? I need my soul healed. He'll fix the gout later on in the resurrection. Has to have a human soul. The Monophysite position was a little bit different. It was that, well, you know, he has a single nature that's divine human. I mean, I guess kind of like a solution in chemistry. You know, you pour two things together, it make a third. And that's a caricature of their position. I know that you know, modern people who hold that would probably resist that caricature. And I apologize. I just can't think of a better way to describe it. But again, the church says no, because a mixture is not, you know, the unique elements. And you have a unique human nature. You have the unique divine nature. Hypostatically conjoined. Hypostatic means in the person. That's the mystery. Now, you can get a really, really lengthy, highly scholastic, very learned description of this in a recent book by the Dominican priest and the rector of the Angelicum. And Reverend Father Thomas Joseph White has a magnificent academic volume, came out, say, in the last 5 years, all about the metaphysics of the hypostatic union. The title escapes me. I think it may be called The Incarnate Lord, but I'm not sure about that. Anyway, you can look up Thomas Joseph White, his recent book on the Incarnation, which goes more into the, you know, the philosophy behind the description. But that's what I can do on the air.
Suzanne's a first-time caller in Ann Arbor, Michigan, listening to us on Ave Maria Radio. Suzanne, thanks so much for holding. You're on with Dr. Anders.
Oh, hi. It's nice to be able to talk to you. My question, I'm coming at this as a former. I've been received into the church. I will be confirmed at Easter, at the Easter Vigil. But I'm coming at this from the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Very conservative doctrinal church. Once Sola Scriptura fell, for me, it was like so many people, it was like the dominoes, you know, the row of dominoes just falling down. And so the Marian dogmas, once I was able to get past the first one, also, dominoes falling, the rest of them were no problem. And by the time I got to the fourth Marian dogma, I just sort of said, I just trust Jesus. Like, he's going to lead me into the truth. I don't really need to have an absolute understanding of the Assumption. However, my friends who are still in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, particularly pastors, are very concerned for the well-being of my soul and have come back to me saying, there is absolutely no biblical basis for the fourth doctrine. How can you possibly believe this?
Yeah.
And I don't really feel like at this point I can say, well, I just trust Jesus with everything else, so I don't need to understand it. Like, that's not a sufficient answer for them. So I was wondering if you could give me your own insights into, there are, in the first three doctrines, there are some biblical bases for the belief, and I guess, what would you say about the fourth?
Yeah, thanks. So if I'm talking to a Lutheran pastor and he raises this objection, I think the first thing I might ask him is if he believes in the canonicity of the book of James. And this is not accidental to the question, right? And my guess is he probably does. There are a few, like, pretty radical Lutherans out there that dispute the canonicity of the epilegumena of the New Testament, the disputed books of the New Testament. Most of them accept them as canonical. I picked James in particular because Luther didn't like it. And, you know, he once said he wanted to get it out of his Bible. But presuming he assumes the canonicity of James, if you don't want to work James, I mean, take any biblical book. Take Romans, for that matter, Luther's favorite book in the Bible. And I'd say, do you accept the canonicity of this book? And if so, why? The why is the really big question. What's the biblical evidence? What's the biblical evidence that the book of James belongs in the New Testament canon? Well, of course, there's none. There's no biblical evidence that it belongs in the canon. There's not one passage of Scripture that says, you know, honor thy father and mother and make sure you keep James in the canon. Right? It's not in there any more than it is for Romans or Matthew or Revelation or any other biblical book. We don't arrive at our canonical list because it was given to us in inspired Scripture. Right? That's not how we get it. We get it from the tradition of the church. And so when you toss sacred tradition as an independent witness to divine revelation, right, then ultimately you destroy even the doctrine of the Bible, because the contents of the Bible itself are handed to us through no other media other than sacred tradition. Either you trust tradition or you don't. Luther, in a tremendous act of inconsistency, once said about the real presence. He said, even if we had no scripture, I would believe this doctrine because the entire consensus of the whole Christian church is in favor of it everywhere you go 1,500 years throughout the world. And to disagree with such a consensus would be a terrible and awful thing, right? So in terms of biblical evidence, the best we can do on the assumption is to pull out some allegories from the Old Testament. But of course, that's not why we believe in the assumption. We believe in it because of the explicit teaching of sacred tradition and the teaching authority of the Catholic Church, which are organs of revelation and infallibility. And unfortunately, here comes the music. I would really like to develop this at greater length, but there you go.
On behalf of our host, Dr. David Anders, our producer, Pedro Quiles, our call screener, Matt Kubensky, and our social media maven today, Mr. Michael McCall, I'm Jack Williams sitting in for Tom Price today, asking you, what's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? It's EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. God bless.